5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
I know you're gonna dig this.
Welcome to the Barrett Sports Media Podcast.
Think we could listen to the radio or something?
Radio? Who needs a radio?
Featuring the biggest names and newsmakers from the world of sports media.
Don't act like you're not impressed.
Now, here's your host, the president of Barrett Sports Media, Jason Barrett.
From coast to coast to across the globe to wherever you're receiving the sound of my voice, welcome to the Barrett Sports Media Podcast. I'm Jason Barrett, the conductor of this audio thrill ride, and your connector to some of the best and brightest minds and talents of the sports media industry. This week, I'm coming to you from the City of Sin, Las Vegas, where the NAB show has infiltrated the area and brought together some of the most influential people from the worlds of radio, television, digital, and social media, journalism, and tech. As someone who's always striving to learn more and discover new ideas and practices to utilize in the sports radio business, I feel it's time well spent. You can find out more about the NAB show by logging on to their website, nabshow.com. On today's episode, I'm thrilled to welcome ESPN Los Angeles morning host George Sedano as my guest. Some of you may know George from his national presence on ESPN and Fox Sports Radio, or maybe you've listened to him in the Miami market during his start there. He's been in Los Angeles now since September, where he's hosted daily each morning alongside Keyshawn Johnson and LZ Granderson. If I can trouble you while you're listening to the episode to leave a review on iTunes, it'd be greatly appreciated. I know I mention it a lot, but the only way for others to know the podcast is worth their time is to see what others have been saying about it. So please take 2 minutes to leave a positive note for yours truly. We've got a lot to explore and not a lot of time to do it. So without further ado, let's dive into this week's starting point.
Quiet on the set. Can we please have quiet on the set?
Action! The industry has been buzzing since Friday when Mike and the Mad Dog reunited at the Tribeca Film Festival to present the premiere of their 30 for 30 documentary, which is scheduled to debut on July 13th on ESPN. During an onstage conversation with Mike Francesa and Chris the Mad Dog Russo, the sports pope, as he's known to New York sports media folks, left open the door for a reunion with his former partner, saying, "Would I listen if something is brought up? Why not? It would be fun." He then added that he still has a lot of people to talk to and isn't even halfway done with his process. One thing I respect about Mike is that he's a masterful negotiator. Nobody uses the press and airwaves better to keep a story alive about his future better than Mike Francesa. If he announced that a reunion with Russo wouldn't make sense, it would hurt his bargaining power. Given that he's entering free agency when his contract expires in January, that would make absolute zero sense. Instead, it keeps the pressure on SiriusXM to step up with an offer that gets him excited. It puts more heat on WFAN, who are in the process of switching ownership groups, by the way, from CBS to Entercom, to create a plan which would convince Francesa to reverse course and stay on board. It also behooves Francesa to entice others such as MSG, SNY, and the YES Network to present possibilities that would feature him on television. Plus, the opportunity to leverage his friendship with Bill Simmons can't be discounted because he could always create a digital brand on Simmons' digital platform, The Ringer. All of that being said, Mike Francesa is a radio guy. He's been a dominant player on the New York airwaves for nearly 30 years, and although he's 63 and on the downside of his career, he still brings huge ratings and revenue power to any radio station which would feature him. Cumulus knows all about situations like this. They allowed Scott Shannon to get away from WPLJ years ago, assuming that his best days were behind him, and all Shannon did was head over to WCBS-FM, where his arrival has led a resurgence for the brand. The other possibility that you can't discount for Mike is the option of exploring a move into news talk. Although it's a long shot, don't think for a second that if the money and platform weren't right, that Francesa wouldn't entertain it. In fact, in the past year, if you've listened to Mike on the air, he's introduced much more conversation about Donald Trump and politics than he has in years past. Colin Cowherd acknowledged during his last contract negotiations that he met with MSNBC. Keith Olbermann moved to MSNBC after a successful career in sports, and former WFAN midday host Sid Rosenberg and former NBC sports anchor Len Berman now host news talk shows on WABC and WOR in the Big Apple. With Don Imus being a longtime friend of Francesa's and facing the end of his Hall of Fame career in the foreseeable future, could that friendship be enough to convince Mike to carry the baton and jump to ABC, where he'd instantly go head-to-head with his rivals Boomer and Carton? What if the show included a TV simulcast with a national news network? You think Fox News couldn't use a boost right now? Or that MSNBC wouldn't do another radio TV simulcast when they've already shown that they're open to adding sports personalities on their network? When you've been a difference maker in the industry, interest is going to come from all directions. Many assumed the market for Mike would be limited without WFAN involved. But don't expect that to be the case. When you're talented on the radio and a high-level revenue generator, and you combine those skills with the ability to leverage the press to increase the demand for your services, you often land firmly on your feet with a heavier wallet. Where do you guys expect Mike Francesa to land? I look forward to your responses. You could reach me by email at jbarrett@sportsradiopd.com or on Twitter at @sportsradiopd. It's time now to bring you this week's sports media conversation, and it takes place with someone I've been a professional admirer of for quite some time. That would be George Sedano. Over the years, we've had the opportunity to grow our professional respect for one another into a friendship that's made it possible to dive into subjects about the business that are important and explore them in candid fashion. I think you'll hear some of that during this particular interview, and I'm pleased to bring it your way right now.
And now, our feature presentation.
Born in New York, now living in L.A., but your career actually started in South Florida. You actually interned for Scott Kaplan and Sid Rosenberg. That had to be an interesting experience, to say the least. So take me through the beginning days and how it influenced your desire to pursue the industry.
Yeah, those were some crazy times. those are kind of the wild, wild west days of sports radio. And Jason, thanks for having me on, of course. Here's what I would say. I mean, this is 1999, right? Sports radio is, in essence, still somewhat in its infancy. And these were guys who started an internet sports radio show at the old sportsline.com, which then later became cbssports.com. And they were so good at what they did that they became syndicated. And I happened to kind of jump on the train at that time. And look, as a kid growing up, I listened to sports radio all the time because my dad would listen to sports radio, particularly when we left games. So if we went to a Dolphins game or a Hurricanes game or whatever, we'd be listening to a pre- or post-game. So I kind of started to fall in love with sports radio then. I was still kind of, you know, young when we had alarm clock radios. So I would fall asleep listening to a guy named Ed Kaplan, who used to work late nights at WQAM in Miami all the time, and his whole thing was he was on from 10 o'clock at night till the last game ended. And that was his thing. And usually it was around 2 a.m. And sometimes, you know, after that, you know, a guy like who's a buddy of mine now, JT the Brick, would be on. Scott Farrell, both guys I worked with and I'm friends with, would be on even after that in the overnights. And I kind of fell in love with radio that way, right? So I'm going to school. I get this opportunity to intern at Sportsline. And I find out they have a radio department, an audio department. So I was like, yeah, for sure, I'd gravitate to that. So I met with Scott and Sid. It was mostly I met with Scott and the producer at the time, Dean Grossman, whose father is the legendary NFL producer, Sandy Grossman. And I met with those guys, and, you know, they hired me. Like, you're in, kid. Let's do it. So I would go there a couple days a week. And, you know, look, I did intern things. I'd go get them Taco Bell. You know, I'd get them stats. You know, I'd print out stuff for them. You know, I would basically be part of their process, right? So I got very early on an opportunity to see what it took to create a show, which I thought was very helpful because, you know, you kind of don't have that kind of guidance usually when you're that young in the business. And I was 21 at that time.
Okay.
So it was a pretty good experience to be around those guys. And clearly those guys have gone on to have amazing careers. So it was a great place to start for me because those guys were really good to learn from.
So following the internship, when did you land your first paid assignment in local radio? You were also doing a wrestling show at one point, right?
That's how I got on the air initially. So here's what happened. Scott Kaplan was tight with this guy who was starting a mom-and-pop sports radio station in Miami. WQAM had been the longtime original sports station there from the early 90s or whatever, and they wanted to start an upstart station. So Scott and Sid's show would be part of that lineup as kind of the syndicated midday show, and there'd be some different shows, local shows around it. They actually did try to hire Levitard to that station, but they couldn't figure out something with Dan at that point. You know, which is interesting, right? When you think about where Levitard's career has gone from a radio perspective. I mean, clearly at that point, he was an unbelievably respected, columnist and journalist and whatnot. So I started there as kind of a board op slash producer. And eventually I got a chance to do updates because the update guy got into a fight with one of my bosses and my boss fired him. So I started doing updates. This was at the time when wrestling was monstrous, all right? We're talking about like 99, 2000, right? Like,
yep.
This is the Attitude Era, WCW versus WWE. So there was a real appetite. They were beating Monday Night Football in the ratings. So they were like, let's do a wrestling show on Saturday evenings or whatever. Or maybe it was Sundays. I don't remember. But it was on the weekend. So, you know, I'm 21, 22 years old, and I thought, like, hey, whatever. Whatever I got to do to get on the air, like, I'm going to do that. So I got reps doing that on the weekend, and that led to reps getting sports reps, like normal sports talk reps on the weekends, which then eventually led to getting on the air at 22 years old every day, 5 days a week. Now, granted, this is a mom-and-pop station, man. Like, we were worrying about getting paid, okay, in a lot of cases. Like, there was a point, and obviously eventually they went bankrupt. People were going to, you know, deposit their checks because this is pre, direct deposit days. And checks were bouncing, dude. So, like, it was literally as you got your check, it was a rush to go to the nearest bank to get it deposited. And forget about going to your bank. Like, you went to the bank of record for the station.
Right.
Because you wanted to get the money right away. And then you could deposit it in your bank. Like, it was that crazy at that point. But look, the opportunity I got at 21, 22 years old to be on the air was tremendous. First of all, there wasn't very many guys in that town or probably anywhere at that stage getting that kind of opportunity to be on the air 5 days a week, even if it was on a station that people barely could hear because it was 1700 on the dial. And yeah, then the station went belly up and, I was out of work for 9 months until I landed my next gig. I almost thought I was out of the business at that point.
So you spend a few years in South Florida and eventually land on the radar of Fox Sports Radio. How does that situation come about?
When the first station, the mom and pop station, went belly up, I was out of work for, 8-9 months, whatever it was, as far as, the radio is concerned. I couldn't jump onto QAM because, and this is what happens, you know how this works, particularly when you're young and dumb, and you're the upstart station, you're taking tons of shots at the big guy, right?
Right.
So I may have crossed the line a few times, right? Like, I may have said some really mean things about Hank Goldberg. So QAM basically had blackballed me. The program director there, I think his name at the time was Duff Lindsay, and Greg Reed was the general manager there, and they were like, screw this punk Sedano, like, the hell with him. He wants to talk all this crap. You know what? He's never going to get a job in this town again. So I was like, all right. So I was pretty much screwed. And I was just thinking, like, trying to plot my next move. I was like, do I go to another town? Like, I was sending tapes all over the place. And here's the thing. I learned very quickly that very few people would even respond to you, let alone give you actual feedback. But the one guy who did was a guy you had on your podcast recently, who I ended up working for, named Tom Lee.
Yep.
And he was in Seattle at the time, and he actually gave me really good feedback on my tape. There were certain guys who are still program directors, one guy who told me, I don't have time to air check my own guys, let alone air check someone I've never met before. So that's just kind of the deal, right? Like, some of the stuff you deal with. So anyway, I get back on the air in Miami because Clear Channel flips one of their AM stations to a sports station. Now, it's mostly Fox Sports Radio. There wasn't any real local programming except for 1 hour in the afternoon. I was doing updates for that station, the News Talk station, WIOD, which had the Heat games, right? I was kind of covering events. I was just starting all over again, basically. And what ends up happening is the guy who was hosting the one-hour show was the sports director for the 2 AMs. He gets fired because he gets into a fight with his boss. The boss there, Peter Bolger, tells me, hey, you want to do the show? for the 1 hour. And I was like, hell yeah. So I did the show, and then it went very quickly from 1 hour to 2 hours because they're like, oh, this kid can do this. And things started picking up. Sales started picking up. And, yeah, like I started doing working there and then doing afternoons there, 5 to 7. Here's how I end up on Fox Sports Radio. So I'm doing that show there, and at that time I'm thinking to myself, hey, if you're in sports talk radio, you need to be at Radio Row in the Super Bowl, right? Like, all I've known is every year when I'm listening to sports talk radio, Jim Rome's at the Super Bowl, and all the national guys are at the Super Bowl, and all the big-name local guys are at the Super Bowl. So I'm like, I got to get to the Super Bowl, right? Like, this is how this works. I tell my boss I want to go to Radio Row, Pete Bolger, and he's like, nah, we don't have that in the budget, man. Like, no, we're not going to do that. So I'm like, okay. So I decided to go on the NFL's media website myself, find out what the cost would be. I would book my own hotel, book my own flight. I asked one of the engineers at Clear Channel to teach me how to set up a remote, and he did. And I said, all right, I'm going to do this myself, whether he likes it or not. So I did it. I booked at a Road Weigh-In in Houston. This is the year that Janet Jackson had the booby gate thing. and the Patriots were playing the Panthers. And I set it all up myself. And I went to Bolger and I said, hey, I know you said you didn't want to pay for it, so I'm going to pay for all of this. And I'm going to go. And I've already booked everything. And I've already, you know, the engineers already taught me how to set it up. So I'm good to go. And he kind of looked at me like I was crazy. So he comes to me the next day and he says, hey, while you're out there, I reached out to my guy, Andrew Ashwood, who was like a childhood friend of mine from Wisconsin. And he's now running Fox Sports Radio with Tom Lee. And they're going to watch over you. And I'm like, okay, cool. And they'll have an engineer kind of checking in on you just in case. I'm like, cool, thanks. So the day before I leave, he then comes up to me again and says to me, by the way, bring the receipts when you're done and I'll figure something out for you. And I was like, all right, this is great. So I get out there. He actually told me, I'm going to extend your show from 2 hours to 4 hours this week if you want to do it. I'm like, yeah, absolutely. The more airtime, the better. So I go and I set up on Sunday, and the Fox Sports Radio engineer was there. I happened to be situated maybe two tables away from their setup. And the guy's name was Robert Grussman, great guy. And I'm sitting down at the table, and I'm just kind of prepping for the show. And Andrew Ashwood walks over, who was the vice president of Fox Sports Radio at the time, and he had just kind of been hired there. He'd moved from San Antonio there. And he introduces himself. And he's like, hey, George, I'm Andrew. Peter's a longtime friend. We used to do a Sunday school together, blah, blah, blah. We start talking just kind of back and forth. Hank Goldberg and I, as I mentioned earlier, had some beef, right? Like, we weren't very nice to each other on the air.
Right.
Hank also was at the table next to me, too. His producer at the time, Dave Hagan, said to me, Hank is pissed. He's like, why are we next to Sedano? Like, he could, you know, like, it's just stupid radio stuff, right? Like, who cares, you know? But I'm loving every second that he's annoyed. And Ashford and I have been talking for like 15 or 20 minutes. Goldberg comes by and says, hey, Andrew, this is George. And he's like, yeah, we just met. And he goes, he's pretty good. You guys should get together. And then I was going to jump in and say, yeah, we've been talking. And he goes, just let the old man think he introduced you to me. Just let him do it. Like, it'll make him feel good. Like, it's all good. So I start my show, do the first segment out of the box, like a bat out of hell, you know, kind of hot, you know, I mean, listen, anybody who's listened to me at this point knows the energy is kind of my thing, right? Like, I feed off the emotion of whatever the day presents itself as far as the news is concerned. And I fire off my opinions, you know, always kind of like a bat out of hell in that first segment. 15 minutes later, segment's over or whatever, Ashwood comes back to me, gives me his business card, says, let's go have a drink tonight. And that's how I ended up on Fox Sports Radio. So had I not basically tried to pay my own way to the Super Bowl, I would have never gotten my first network gig because none of that would have ever happened.
The biggest lesson in that for anyone listening right now is to invest in yourself because it can pay off for you. I mean, just the fact that you were paying for it, but also learning how to set up your own remote. How many guys these days are not willing to sleep in a roadway inn and set up their own broadcast? And look at what it did for your career. As it applies, though, to Fox Sports Radio. Once you're on the network level, and I mean, this is your early 20s, what was that experience like?
I loved it, right? And especially doing late night, overnight radio. Like, remember what I told you a few minutes ago. That's what I grew up on. I would listen to, you know, the local guy at Kaplan. I was listening to Scott Farrell, and I was listening to JT the Brick. And now I'm on after JT the Brick. You know what I mean?
Like, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was pretty awesome. It was kind of like, hey, I've made it to do something. Like, this is kind of crazy that this has happened this fast. Miami is a pretty transient town. Like, there are a ton of locals, but I would also say it's like the sixth borough of New York, because there's so many transplanted New Yorkers in South Florida, right? Miami, right. Fort Lauderdale, Palm Beach. So things that happen in the Northeast particularly are things that you're going to be talking about if you're doing sports talk radio in Miami beyond just the Miami stuff. So it wasn't that big of a transition for me. At least it didn't feel that way, even though it probably was because of that. And I was originally going to move to LA at that time to do Fox Sports Radio, but Clear Channel also wanted me to host the pre- and post-game stuff for the Heat. They had just traded for Shaq. So I did the show in Miami, and basically my day was this. Whenever I was done with the show, at 6 in the morning East Coast time, I'd go to bed sometime before 7 and wake up at like 2 or 3 o'clock and get ready for my day and really kind of get ready for the NBA day. And that's kind of what I did for 3.5 years, basically. So the fact that Shaq, who was the biggest star in the NBA at the time, was coming to my town, and the fact that I can just go to him and say, hey, Shaq, can I sit down and get an interview and run that overnight? I bet you there's never been a show in the history of man in sports talk radio that's ever had Shaquille O'Neal appear on overnight. Like, there's no chance that ever happened, right?
Right.
Like, there's no chance Pat Riley has ever been on another overnight show, but I had access to these guys. So, yeah, it was crazy. I guess the only part of the transition that was tough was this. If you feel really strongly and passionate and you feel like you've got the right reasons to do something and you've kind of researched this, you should follow your instincts in that case. And I'll explain. So when I got to Fox Sports Radio, their vision, Andrew's vision at the time, Andrew Ashford's vision, was for me to be what I was in Miami, a one-man band, just going at it like a crazy person, you know, somewhere between JT the Brick and Jim Rome, right? Who were the guys who were doing it at a very high level at that time. And I said, yeah, okay, cool. That's what I've always done. But when I started doing the show, I was having conversations with my crew who were in Los Angeles. And my producer was really funny kid, you know, black kid, Marcel Hall. My update person, Karen Kay, a female, really funny, you know, they all grew up in L.A., so they kind of knew the West Coast really well. Mm-hmm. And then my board ops kid named Josh Gears, just funny kid from Pennsylvania, like really just unbelievable as far as timing is concerned on a board with sound and drops, and just kind of knew where I was always going, really good at reading me. And they were all kind of quirky in their own way. We'd always have these great conversations. And so the first time I'm on, I just said, you know what? I'm just going to ask them, right? Like, why not? Hey, Marcel, Karen, Josh, so what does this feel like in L.A.? We just built this immediate rapport, right? Like, we had this great chemistry from the first second the four of us cracked the mic that I said to myself, I'm going to keep leaning on these guys because, yeah, I'm kind of the centerpiece, but these are really good role players who know what they're doing, right? And I thought of it like a basketball team. You've got Shaq, but you need Robert Horry and Rick Fox and Derek Fisher, right? Like, you need those players. So I thought of it in that sense, and I'm like, it was more fun to do it that way, too, because they were hilarious, and we kind of messed with each other, and it kind of created this morning zoo in the middle of the night. So we just let it roll, right? And we'd do it, we'd have a blast, and we'd go off on crazy tangents about music and movies and TV shows and pick on each other and fight with each other like we were siblings. And it became something that was kind of like this cult thing in the middle of the night. Well, my bosses were like, yeah, we don't want you to do that. We want you to be the solo guy, bat out of hell guy. And I was like, but why? And they're like, but that's just what we want. And I said to them, well, listen, think about who I'm competing against at the time. And at the time, it was Todd Wright on ESPN Radio,
right.
Solo guy,
yep,
doing his own thing, just him. And Kevin Wheeler, who's in St. Louis now, who was on Sporting News Radio. And he was doing that same style of show that Todd Wright was doing. So I said, why would I do the same show that they're doing? Now, do I think I could do it better than them? Yeah, of course you always think you could do it better. But why wouldn't I do something completely different? And they were kind of fighting me on that. And it took about 6 months And then my affiliate guy, Kirk Kretschmar, came to me and was like, yo, we're getting all these new affiliates. And they weren't just sports affiliates, Jason. They were like news talkers. Because remember, if you've listened to overnight radio, sports and alien talk, right? With like George Norrie.
Right.
So those are really your only options. So we created this morning zoo, even though they were like, we don't want this morning zoo. And then about 6 months in, when we start getting all these affiliates that aren't even sports related, this was at a time where even network radio was 10 years old, basically, in most cases. So it was still somewhat young. And we went from like 180 to like 300 very quickly because it was just so different than anything else that was on in the middle of the night. And Andrew Ashwood, to his credit, he's one of the few bosses, if not really the only boss, if I can think about it, that's ever come up to me and said, you were right. Keep doing the crazy morning zoo. I was wrong. And I was like, wow, that was real validation at a time where, I mean, man, I'm 26 years old. Like, and here's this guy who's been doing radio for 20-something years as a programmer, and he's telling me I'm right. Like, that felt pretty damn good. Maybe some of the most fun I've ever had in radio ever were those 3.5 years that I did that.
Now, after you spent time with Fox, you then had time on 790 to Ticken and WQAM in Miami to mark its two top sports radio brands. And a little while ago, you mentioned how transient of a town Miami is and how it's essentially the sixth borough of New York. You've seen it from both sides. So tell me, as someone who's been on the inside, what do those brands do well, and which one has a stronger connection to the local community?
Well, initially, I would say when I was young, it was QAM. But very quickly, the Ticket started to create a thing that was completely different. That's what you want in this business. You want to find different. Now, different doesn't always work. It's got to be different and good, right? It can't just be different for the sake of being different. But when the Ticket launched, they tried to hire me in 2004. But here's the thing. This was a mom-and-pop station at the time, the Ticket. And I'm like, oh, I've already done that, man. Been there, done that, bought the T-shirt. I don't want to have to run to some bank and cash my checks again. Like, I'm getting offered a network gig. I get to host the pre and post game for the Heat. Like, this is the stability I'm looking for. You know what I mean? Like, thanks, but no thanks. And I love those guys, obviously. John Wiener, who started the station, who's Stu Gatz on the Levitard show. It's crazy to think that he started a radio station. They really wanted me to jump on that station, and their offer to me was kind of be the sidekick to Joe Rose, who's been the longtime morning guy in Miami.
Right.
And I was kind of like, nah, I don't want to be anybody's sidekick. Like, no thanks, you know? And on top of the stability thing and all that, after doing overnights for 3+ years, even in my 20s, man, like, it was taxing. That's just not a lifestyle I think you can do forever. So, especially because I was doing most of it on the East Coast, like I'd spend a few months or whatever in the summer in LA, but most of the grind was done on the East Coast. So, you know, my dad was also, his health wasn't great at the time, so I was dealing with that, and I was like, I just want to be in Miami full time. So I basically opened it up, like, hey, I want to come back to Miami, my contract's up. Andrew, who was my boss at Fox, had also gotten sick. He passed away of cancer a number of years ago. I remember having a conversation with Andrew, maybe 4, 5, 6 months out of my contract was going to expire. And I said to him, hey, look, here's what I'm thinking. I'm getting tired doing overnights. Is there something else available? He says, well, look, I'm going to be honest with you. All our other spots are locked in under contract. But look, we definitely think of you as more than just an overnight guy. Like, we feel like that's a good first step. And when something does open, you're going to be the first considered. But that may not happen for a while because we've got guys locked in. I'm like, okay, cool. QAM had offered me an opportunity to do a show, but they wanted me to have a co-host. And it was only 2 hours. I was like, nah, that doesn't sound ideal. Then the Ticket was like, hey, you can do middays. And I, you know, living in Miami, I was listening to that station because it appealed more to me. All the guys were in their 30s or even younger. I was in my late 20s, and they just spoke to me. And I could see that the station was making real inroads. Like, you know, the coveted demo in sports talk radio is 25 to 54. And, you know, they were losing 25-54, but their 18 to 34 numbers, Jason, were like beating some of like the big FM stations.
Yep.
On a little piddly AM. Like, it was insane how the young audience was flocking to this AM station in Miami. So I'm like, yeah, this might be the place that I want to go to. So I basically told John Wiener, Stu Gatz, I think I'm going to go there, send me the contract. Let me let my guys look it over. But I need to fly to L.A. first because I want to talk to Andrew. I don't want him hearing this secondhand. And he's like, yeah, no problem. Totally respect that. Now, here's the problem. I was working at Clear Channel, obviously, at that time. And Pete Bolger was no longer the program director at WIOD, which is the station that had the Heat games. Ken Charles had just come in. He and I had no relationship at that time. And I had told him the same thing at that time. I said, look, I'm looking to leave overnights. Do you have something that you want me to do? Like, you know, they had just flipped the old sports station I used to work on to like Air America or whatever at the time. And he's like, I don't really have anything for you. So I'm like, okay, well, I'm probably going to look around. I'm just letting you know. Like, I'm not trying to hide anything here. And he's like, okay, yeah, no problem. So I fly to L.A. Andrew Ashwood is dealing with chemotherapy. He's not in the office all the time. I'm like, all right, I'm going to stay here as long as it takes to get a face-to-face with him. Like, I'm constantly telling people at the office, like, let me know when he's there. I extended my trip. My original trip was like a week. I extended it for like another like 4 or 5 days just in case because he hadn't been in the office yet. And then I'm getting calls from Ken Charles saying, I know you're going to the ticket. I'm going to lock you out of the building or whatever. Like, how can you do this to me? And I was like, dude, first of all, I haven't signed anything. Second of all, I haven't done anything because I want to talk to Andrew. I'm in L.A. and I want to get his guidance and figure out what I want to do. I may not leave Clear Channel. So Ken was like, okay, fine. I'm like, just don't tell him anything because I want to be the person to talk to him about it. And he's like, yeah, no problem. So I get to the premier offices in L.A., and I see Andrew, and, you know, he was a big, gregarious, like, boisterous, lovable character, right? And he's like, give me a hug, babe. And he gives me his big hug, and he'd lost some weight, obviously, at the time because of the chemo and the cancer. And I went over there, and I said, and he says to me, so tell me about this 790 thing. And I look at him, I'm like, what? And he's like, yeah, Ken's been blowing up my phone. I didn't want to make Ken Charles feel like Darth Vader, by the way. I do actually get along with Ken Charles. He and I actually have grown to have a friendship and a relationship. He's actually in L.A. now, so we're good. So I said to him, hey, look, man, here are my options. And he's like, well, I just want to let you know you have a third option. And he slides a contract in front of me to keep doing overnights for, you know, more money or whatever. I'm like, look, man, I appreciate this. I thank you for this opportunity, but I'm tired. Going back home makes a lot of sense. So he said to me, bleep QAM, go to the ticket. And I was like, done deal. That's it. Like, that's all I needed to hear. I felt it, but I trusted him implicitly, and that's why I went to the ticket. And it was for those same reasons. He said, that station is on the rise. It's going to be a powerhouse. You're going to end up having one of the best lineups in the country in local radio. Because it was going to be Sid Rosenberg in the morning, mm-hmm. me in the midday, John Buchambi, who is the voice of Sunday Night Baseball on ESPN Radio,
right.
doing middays, and then Levitard. So he's like, networks will be jealous of that lineup. That's what made me go there. I had the hunch to say, this is going to be the station that eventually rises. And Ashwood kind of confirmed that for me. And it did. That station took off. And it's still the stronger brand right now. Because what ended up happening was, those young guys that were 18 back then in 2006 or 7 or whatever are in that 25 to 54 demo now. So that's why they became the powerhouse, because we went and attracted all those young guys that became loyal to that particular brand.
So given your history in South Florida, from the outside looking in, you mentioned the 18 to 34s that have been growing, and clearly Miami has gotten better over the last few years when it comes to ratings. But traditionally, they haven't been a very high-rated sports market. You've been there. You know why. Why is that the case?
I would say Miami is unique, much like Los Angeles, where I'm at now, is unique. I think that, and I'm Cuban, I'm Latino, so I think in Miami, I can speak to half the Hispanic population there doesn't even speak English mm-hmm. as their first language. So let's start there. The Miami Hispanic AM stations do crazy numbers. So not only are you competing with the powerhouse FM numbers in English and Spanish, but even the AMs do really well. So it's really hard to compete. And I've noticed LA is very similar to that. Like, if you're getting a 3 share in Miami, men 25-54 or LA, you're knocking it out of the park. Now, if you're getting a 3 share in Kansas City, you're getting fired. You know what I mean? Like that's just the way it works. It's just based on the way the populations are. In my short time in LA, on the morning show, we've only been doing it for 6 months, basically, the Hispanic numbers on ESPN LA in the morning are up like 150% you know, look, I'm going to guess it's because it's me, right? Like, you hear somebody who occasionally will say something in Spanish, and you're like, whoa, wait a second, who's this guy? And I think in Miami there was that. We talked about that report you wrote about diversity in sports talk radio, and we were talking about how proud we were of the fact that ESPN Los Angeles, 710, is the most diverse station in the country. And I came up again today for some reason, and LZ and I were talking about it because Keyshawn's on vacation. He brought it up, and I said, yeah, I wish we could add more Latinos because I'm the only Latino. I wish we had a Mexican-American on the station because L.A. is predominantly Mexican-Americans. It is pretty interesting that I've worked in two markets that are very similar as far as kind of the makeup is concerned, the way radio is made up, both demographically and what the expectations are because of those demographics.
Well, and the weird thing for me is, you know, look, again, you play to what the audience is and what they want, right? So when I look at the design of brands and they don't reflect that, it leaves me scratching my head. Is that the reason why the ratings needle isn't being moved? Even if you had the right demographic on the air, that doesn't mean that the talent's good. So the talent clearly is important in that process too. But you've seen the column, so you know my position on it. One of the biggest concerns I have is that Hispanics in our business right now, if you just go by the top 20 markets, they're less than 2% of on-air hosts who are Hispanic, and you're one of the select few. What does that say to you as far as the current state of our industry? Because from where I sit, it concerns me.
It concerns me. It's why I mentioned a second ago that we talked about it on the air here locally this morning as it came up. To me, there's no reason that, and it's not, I'm just not putting this on our station, you know, because I've already said this on the air today, but I'm putting it on other stations too, whether it's LA or Miami. In LA, there's no reason there shouldn't be a Mexican-American talk show host in English. Like, I don't get it. Like, are we kidding with that? Like, for real? I think that's something we can do better with. And, you know, I'm not trying to undermine anyone by any stretch of the imagination, but I feel like it would make a lot of sense. In Miami, I'm not on in Miami anymore. Levitard's not, you know, he's a national show. He's not, you know, even though he does the local hour in Miami, so I guess we can count him. There's only two Cubans on in Miami. Like,
exactly.
Are we serious with this? Like, get out of here. Like, how many Cuban people live in Miami, and how is it that after all these generations, you know, dating back to the 50s and 60s when Cubans were exiled and came to mostly South Florida, how is that the case? In the history of South Florida sports talk radio, there have only been three Cuban sports talk hosts on those two stations that have actually had a real run. Myself, Levitard, and Orlando Alzagari at QAM. Like, that's crazy to me.
And all three of you guys have went on to have pretty good careers and success in Miami. All the more reason why there should be more people walking through the door to do more shows there.
Why aren't there more Mexican-Americans on in Dallas or Houston or any of those cities? Like, to me, that's a real thing. When you're talking about 20% of the population is Hispanic, and Hispanic millennials particularly are like the hottest commodity in advertising and marketing. Like, how is that a thing at this point? Here's the problem with Hispanics, right? Latinos are not monolithic. Mexicans, they don't always speak the same language. There's different dialects as Caribbeans, like, you know, Puerto Ricans, Cubans, Dominicans, or whatever.
Right.
And even amongst Cubans, Puerto Ricans, and Dominicans, who are all Caribbean Hispanics, they have their own different dialect and way of life and thinking. And the South Americans are different than the Central Americans. So it's hard. I get that, okay? I do get that. But what I said today is I want to be more monolithic. I want us to rep each other and defend each other and be like, hey, let's pull each other up together because we are fragmented and it hurts us. So I do think that that's important. I do think that we should try to kind of unite more, even though we do have our own little subtle differences, because it's only going to help us to kind of rise together.
Whenever I go through this process, I'm looking at Phoenix, I'm looking at San Diego, I'm looking at Dallas, I'm looking at these populations, you know, in Washington, D.C., pretty heavy African-American population.
Of course,
and
yeah.
I don't see people who reflect those backgrounds. And so then it makes me think, well, we could sit here and dissect numbers and complain about ratings not being high, but the first question I'm going to ask is, are you speaking to the audience that you're broadcasting to with the right people? This is no knock on any talent that's on those stations, because there are a lot of great talent in Miami and Dallas and Phoenix and San Diego. But at some point, you've got to connect with the local people who live in your backyard. And if you don't, because they don't see or hear people that look and sound like them, that's what you got to figure out.
Jason, you hit the nail on the head there at the end. I think the role of a, particularly a local station, regardless of format, okay, is to reflect the community they live in. That, to me, is part of the primary goal. And when they don't, that's why maybe ratings are low. Maybe that's part of the reason, and no one wants to look introspectively about it. I think that those are some real issues. But again, I think it's why I'm so proud of where I work right now, because we've taken that step. We have 7 non-white talk show hosts. Dan Zampillo and Scott McCarthy and those guys have done a phenomenal job with that.
Speaking of opportunity, you've had a lot of them at ESPN. I mean, right now you're in LA, you're working on the local circuit there, but you've also worked on the national stage. And having the experience of seeing how and why it's the dominant brand in sports media, I'm sure this is an issue that ruffles your feathers along the way. When you see some of the negative headlines that have been written about the company over the last few years, how does it sit with you?
It doesn't sit well, because I feel like we're being singled out. Do you think ESPN is the only television network being affected by cord cutting?
Right.
Like, it's preposterous. You know what I mean? Like, get out of here. Look, ESPN makes a ton of money off of cable subscriptions. I get that. We could be talking about, you know, cable subscriptions and television packages, or we could be talking about selling pizzas. Business is business, and business evolves, and things change. And what ends up happening is everyone, when the evolution happens, regardless of whatever the business model is, has to recalibrate and figure out what we need to do to continue to grow at the pace we've been growing. And sometimes you're going to hit rough patches in the growth. And that's just the reality of the world we live in, because the entire world, Jason, is an ebb and a flow. There's never like a straight line shooting all the way up to the stars, right? So yeah, it does piss me off. I got to be honest with you, because ESPN has given me an unbelievable opportunity, and I love working for the company. And if you notice, a lot of people do clap back and snap back when people say that stuff. I know Scott Van Pelt's been really vocal about that stuff in a number of publications. And I think a lot of us feel the way Scott does. It's like, I mean, what are we talking about here? Like, why are we being singled out? Like, this seems silly. But that's part of the deal, right? You work here, you got to take the good and the bad, right? And sometimes the good is when it's great, you know, you get all the recognition. And sometimes when even the silliest of things happen, you know, it gets blown out of proportion.
What it speaks to is that people love to root against the Yankees, Cowboys, and Lakers, right? When you're on top of the mountain, you got the bullseye on you. And the reason why you're on top of the mountain is because they've been pretty damn good for the last 30-plus years.
Yeah, and look, man, there's a lot of really smart people in Bristol, man. Like, I'm telling you, I spent 3 years there. There are a lot of really smart people there. And ESPN's going to be fine. Like, we're good. Like, you can write all the blogs you want about the demise of ESPN. No, we're good.
So I've got to ask you about some ESPN on ESPN crime. You and Jonathan Coachman having a fun little spat recently on social media, which I'm sure had to make you think, man, Twitter can be the best and the worst all in one day. What was that all about?
You want to talk about something that gets blown out of proportion. It was that. Like, you know, he thought I ripped off one of his segments on SportsCenter. I had no idea that he did a segment like that on SportsCenter. Producer wanted me to do something on my TV show, Nacion ESPN, which is every Monday at 5 p.m. Eastern. I just do what I'm told, right? Like, producer's like, hey, we're doing this word association segment. This is what we're doing. So I just kind of took umbrage with it in a playful way. You know, look, man, what ends up happening, right? Like, anybody in a family, you start poking at each other, and sometimes things get a little too silly and personal. But yeah, it really was nothing. Like, we're good. He and I are fine. There's no issue. There's no beef.
All right. So I want to touch on a couple areas of the craft, and then I'm going to wrap up on what I call quick hits. You're working with Keyshawn Johnson and LZ Granderson, two very opinionated people. When you combine them with yourself, that means you've got three very unique viewpoints, guys with a lot to say to present daily content to the audience. So from the driver's chair, how do you make sure to get your own touches into the show while still highlighting what each of those guys do in the right spots?
Well, it's funny you mentioned that. When we got together to start to do the show, like, my analogy to them was, and I'm not trying to compare myself to him, like this guy, but I just used the point guard analogy. So I used Steve Nash, right?
Yep.
Like, Nash is going to get you a lot of assists. He's going to get you the ball in the right place. You can hit the shot. But there's going to be times he's going to want to go to the bucket too and take some shots. And that's it. Look, it isn't easy all the time because, yeah, we're three highly opinionated people. What ends up happening, Jason, is, and as someone who's worked in the business as a programmer, you get this, and I feel like this is a good thing. Because we're three highly opinionated people and we have a lot of things to say about particular subjects, a lot of stuff gets left on the cutting room floor that we probably could have gotten to. But look, there's always another show the next day, right? Like, I think that that's kind of the beauty of working with three highly opinionated people, is that there hasn't been a day where I've said, we had nothing to talk about. We really had to labor through that show. Look, is it hard sometimes because you want to kind of get your way and you know, you want to be able to kind of get your two cents in? Sometimes. I think early on it was more difficult than it is now, because we didn't know each other. I knew we had something within the first 90 minutes of my first show. I sent my boss, Dan Zampillo, an email and said, this is going to work, because the chemistry was immediate. It was just a matter of making sure everybody felt like they got enough touches. And yeah, like, that's not a problem. And Jason, look, I'm secure enough in my role and in my place in this business, right, that, you know what, there are a couple of segments that are really fast moving that I give them more of an opportunity to kind of get their opinions out there. And then I'll just kind of go with some quick hitters and then we move it along, right? Like, we have some segments that are kind of fast paced and I'll let them shine because I'm fine with that. And I think that's the problem, is when you're doing shows with people who feel like they need to prove themselves, that can become a problem because they're not playing within the team construct, right? None of us are in that stage. Like, the three of us have worked at very high levels on radio and television before. So nobody's like, oh, I need the ball. You know, like you're taking too many shots. We don't have that.
An area of broadcasting that's very subjective, and it's really important from the driver's chair, is formatics. That means teasing what's next, diving into content when you come back from a break immediately, resetting subjects. Where do you stand on the importance of executing those items each day?
Oh, I think it's tremendously important. It's something that I didn't really think about very much until I started listening to Cowherd, you know, years ago. I think Colin's really good at it. And then obviously working, you know, at ESPN, and I got a chance, like, I didn't really listen to Mike and Mike much before I got to ESPN because it just wasn't on in Miami. But then when I heard Greeny, you're like, good Lord, like, he's amazing at it. So those two guys kind of made me think that way. And, you know, a lot of that was Scott Masteller, who used to work at ESPN. That's his thing. He's probably as smart a PPM guy as I've ever met. So he kind of ingrained that into your head very quickly. And the people who have worked there since also believe in that. To me, you got to come back. You got to reset. Even in interviews, you got to make sure you reset, let people know who you're talking to. You know, you got to move forward, tease forward, not just the next segment. Sometimes if you have a guest, you want to make sure people know, hey, you know, coming up in 30 minutes is such and such. Like, I think all those things are really important because it's scientifically proven. We have the data, right, that people are in and out of their cars more in morning drive than any other time because you're getting in the car and maybe you're getting gas and maybe you're going in your car again and you're going to go get some coffee at Starbucks and then you're getting back in your car and you're dropping your kids off at school and, you know, you get back in your car and you're going to work, right? So there's a lot of in and out. I took a lot of that from listening to Greeny and the instruction I got at ESPN and obviously Colin and what he was able to do. And I kind of took that to heart, and I've really made that a big part of what I do in my role. Keyshawn likes to make fun of me because he says I'm the fun police with the clock. And I just said to him, look, man, in the NFL, a coach is going to get fired if he's got bad clock management. So you're just going to have to deal with it and just let me go when I got to go. And I said, I'm not ending him. We're just pausing him. It's different.
One thing that's less of a focus on a national level but is a bigger focus on the local level is phone calls. Where do you stand on how critical they are to a talk show?
Elsie and I had this conversation this morning in the elevator on the way downstairs. And Jason, I used to be a big proponent of calls, and more I'm less of a proponent of calls. To me, it's about the producer screening the calls and just telling you, hey, this guy's going to be good. Like, you have to trust your producer there. I mean, outside of like the anomaly when something so big happens, right, that you want to hear from the audience in your local town, I don't think it's as big a deal anymore. We were talking about the story where Khloe Kardashian basically said that if Tristan Thompson proposed to her, that she would say yes. So I said, man, that's a lot of pressure. You know, like you just said that to a national publication. You know, yeah. I'm sure LeBron's like, yo, dude, if you're going to propose, you better wait till June. So we kind of started talking about, I told the story about a friend of mine whose girlfriend, they had been high school sweethearts and they were in their mid-20s and they were engaged and she had set a date and he was still kind of like, I guess we're getting married. And she basically laid down the law and said, I'm getting married on this day with him or without him. And so I told that story. And then, you know, we got a couple of people who chimed in with some fun, similar stories. And, you know, but again, to me, that was on the producer to say, this guy's got a great story. Let's put him on. So I think that there is a place for calls, but I think it's far more sparse and scarce than it used to be. Like, I don't think it's as important. To me, it's an accent as opposed to something that drives the show. The person who drives the show should be the host in the chair driving the content and, you know, even to an extent, the guests. But even with guests, Jason, like, I'm all about, don't just stop dead cold in your tracks because a guest is coming on. If you're having that fun conversation and the guest comes on, ask them, hey, here's what happened. What do you think? Like, do you have a story like that? Now, granted, it's on the producer to ask them first. And if they do, then you know to go there. But yeah, like I do think that calls have a place, but certainly not as big a place as they used to.
One last content piece I want to touch on, and then I'll wrap up with the quick hits, is you're in a market where you've got two baseball teams, two basketball teams, two hockey teams. You're going to have two football teams. How do you choose what to focus on in order to play to the biggest segment of the audience, especially when you've got divided interests in a local market?
Well, the good thing is we've got some research on that, about what drives people. The Lakers here are the Yankees, okay? You
right.
can talk Lakers every day with no issues, no problems. I would say the Dodgers kind of come in second after that. And then after that, you know, it kind of just depends on the season, right? Like who's hot, who's not. Like USC was really good this past season, so that helps, right? And they'll be good next season, so that's going to help. I think the Rams stuff is interesting because they're more of an Orange County team, which is not really L.A., but I think that there is some of a fan base there. The Chargers, it's going to be interesting to see how that unfolds because unless they're really good, there's just not a fan base for them here. Even though you can hear our station in San Diego, like that doesn't help us from a rating standpoint necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
The Clippers, as good as they've been, have not made very many inroads. So you kind of know what to talk about, right? Like you're talking about the Lakers, the Dodgers kind of first and second, and then the NFL in general, I would say third. Like, if the Lakers are one and the Dodgers are like two, then the NFL is like 2B. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Like, so it doesn't have to be Rams related because, again, LA, much like some of the other towns we've talked about, really transient. Got tons of Cowboy fans here, tons of Raider fans still in LA. If the Raiders, Jason, were playing in LA, they'd outdraw any of these teams, any of the football teams. And then everyone else kind of falls in after that, like USC and then basically everyone else. Like we talked some UCLA basketball this year because of Lonzo and LeVar. We were kind of the first guys to put LeVar Ball on the air, for better or worse.
Yeah, the rest of the nation is now cursing you for that. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. And he was, in essence, a fourth co-host for a minute there. But you have to kind of feel it out, right? Like you have to know what's hot. Like when we talk about the NBA playoffs, the Lakers will be done. So, you know, you'll probably focus a little more on the Clippers. Can they get past the second round finally? That kind of thing. And the NBA is big here. People, you can talk NBA just as much as you can talk NFL. The national stories here work because it's a transient town too. If you're talking LeBron on ESPN radio, then you're talking LeBron on ESPN Los Angeles if the story warrants it. Like, I don't think there's any question.
All right, so we're going to wrap up on quick hits. Again, this is not a Jonathan Coachman approved segment, so I hope that works. One thought or one...
Why are you trying to get me in trouble? Stop it.
That's actually me saving my ass, so when he goes off on me for it, I'm not getting killed. One thought or one comment on each of these questions, all right? The most important contribution a producer can make to a talk show is blank.
I would say structure.
The tougher sports radio market to drive big numbers in, Los Angeles or Miami?
They're pretty close, man, because of the landscape and the demographics. I would say Los Angeles just because there's more stations in the number two market than there are in Miami, but it's close.
The one part of the program director's job that George Sedano misses the most is?
Oh yeah, I was the program director at QAM for 11 months.
Yeah.
I try to keep that out of my mind. No, I'm all kidding aside. Building something. I like building things. I thought in a very short amount of time, I built something pretty good there.
And then finally, one piece of advice you'd offer to a young person who's just starting out in the business today is?
Be proactive, man. I think if you're a young kid trying to get yourself on the air, you have an inherent advantage that we didn't have when I was that age. Okay? And God, I just sounded old saying that. podcasts.
Right.
Like, you can give yourself reps. Everybody can do that now. Look at the Barstool guys. I mean, those guys have created an unbelievable business model. But I bet you a bunch of those guys tried to get on Sports Talk Radio at some point or another, and they said, the hell with it. Let's just keep doing this. And their thing grew so big, especially amongst college kids, that they created this cool thing. But programmers need to be willing to take chances. You got to develop people. Go find the kid in your local town who's got the hot podcast and talk to him. Give him a shot. I bet you he'd be willing to do it for a few bucks. And what do you have to lose? A couple of hours on the weekend? To me, Jason, the risk is worth the reward there.
It's been awesome catching up, chatting about the business with you. I knew we'd reconnect and have fun with this. So congrats on all your success at 710 and along the way, of course. And hope the morning wake-up calls aren't kicking your ass too bad.
Initially at 4:30, when the wake-up was at 4:30 in the morning and my mind was still on East Coast time, it was easy. But then eventually it did become 4:30 in the morning. So yeah, it's a little rough. Thank God we have a lot of fun on this show, because if not, the wake-up would be really, really a pain in the ass. But it's fun. I love working where I'm working right now. But thank you, Jason. Thank you for the time, and it was great connecting with you.
This is the Barrett Sports Media Podcast.
My thanks to George Sedano for being so gracious with his time. I hope you guys were listening when he talked about investing in yourself and how it can pay dividends for your career. Ironically, he talked about hosting a wrestling show when he started out. I can relate. I did the same exact thing. If not for that show and going into foreign territory as a broadcaster, I'd have never have landed on Bruce Gilbert's radar and never would have worked for ESPN Radio. So sometimes you have to deviate from your initial plan to get to where you want to be. I also hope some of my programming friends took to heart what he had to say about taking chances and looking for new talent. Many operate safely and gravitate to who and what they know, but you can uncover some incredible gems if you're willing to overturn a couple of rocks that you may not have looked under before. Last but not least, I've been outspoken on the sports radio business needing to do a better job at locating and featuring minority voices on the air. I couldn't imagine being in George's shoes and being only one of 10 in a field of 400 to occupy a significant job in a top 20 market. That's crazy and simply shows that we're not doing a good enough job as an industry. As I tried to communicate during the conversation, that's no knock on any existing talent on a sports station today. It's more of a reflection on the current state of our business. At the end of the day, the brand's challenge is to reflect the community it broadcasts in to ultimately grow ratings. Success should come from people of all walks of life, not just Caucasian males aged 25 to 54. Hopefully, when we look back on this subject in the next 5 years, we'll see progress made. But that's all the time we have for this week. My thanks again to George Sedano and to you for spending your time listening to today's episode. If you're interested in booking me as a radio guest, or if your brand needs help and you wish to discuss business, my contact information is available on the website, sportsradiopd.com. In the words of Kid Rock, if it sounds good, you'll hear it. If it looks good, you'll see it. If it's marketed right, you'll buy it. But if it's real, you'll feel it. So be authentic in everything you do. Until next time, I'm Jason Barrett. Thanks for stopping by.
I'd say that was a pretty successful broadcast.
Thank you for listening to the Barrett Sports Media Podcast. To stay updated on the latest sports media news, follow Jason on Twitter at SportsRadioPD and visit our website, sportsradiopd.com.